It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Authorities, including the FBI, are trying to determine who's behind the sending of crude explosive devices to several prominent figures, including former President Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, former Vice President Joe Biden, and others. Robert Jones is the special agent in charge at the FBI's Pittsburgh office. Robert Jones, welcome to the Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. Thank you.
Okay, you've been on the job here since July. So when you were appointed to the post, did you get any marching orders, any directive from FBI Director Wray?
I did. The director has asked all the special agents in charge to advertise the fact that 99.9% of our cases really have nothing to do with Clinton emails or Russian election interference. Every day, my agents are out there arresting drug dealers and kidnappers. Bank robbers and child pornographers, just doing the Bureau's jobs every day.
Okay. So did the director sort of rely on you and your office, you know, your staff to say, you know, we're on the ground, we have an assessment of what's happening here, and then, you know, sort of formulate that directive?
Sure. Great question. Every year, each of the 56 field offices in the FBI looks at all the investigative priorities across our entire domain, the areas that we are responsible for, and then we kind of rack and stack them based on the threat to our specific domain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned Pittsburgh. I said Pittsburgh because that's the official office, but I don't know if people realize how wide of an area that you cover your jurisdiction.
Sure. The Pittsburgh office of the FBI covers all of western Pennsylvania and the entire state of West Virginia.
All the way up to Erie area?
Correct.
Oh,
correct, yes.
Okay. Quite a large area. And I guess, are there different challenges within that area?
Sure. Again, we look at each area. I have 9 offices across that jurisdiction, and I listen to my supervisors in those offices to sort of tell me how, for instance, Erie might be different than Bedford County.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that 99.9% didn't deal with the Russian investigation and any potential relationship that now President Trump had with the Russians or the emails of Secretary of State Clinton. But I wanted to ask you, do you feel that the FBI's public image suffered at all because of all that attention on those two issues?
I think maybe a little bit more in Washington, D.C. I've noticed in the 3 months that I've been here that I think the public really appreciates what we do. I've had numerous press conferences on multiple cases with Mr. Brady, and I think both the media and the average citizen in western Pennsylvania or West Virginia understands what we do and appreciates that.
Of course, Scott Brady, the U.S. Attorney for western Pennsylvania. I mentioned at the beginning much attention this week paid to the discovery of suspected pipe bombs. At this point, am I correct, no such devices have been discovered in Pittsburgh?
Nothing so far. I think at last count we had 10. There was an additional one found yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Is the FBI overall involved in the investigation because the post, you know, these were delivered through the post office, a federal agency, or would the FBI have been involved anyway?
We probably would have been involved anyway. We'll lead the investigation, but we'll have multiple partners that help us out. The postal inspectors, for instance, mm-hmm. since they were mailed, will be critical in assisting us in this investigation.
I know you can't reveal much in the way of details, I assume, but what's the process? Can you explain to us what the process is when something like this happens?
Sure. For these particular cases, just good old-fashioned investigation will focus you in 3 different areas. So we know that the bombs were mailed, so we've got multiple, we think, mail facilities that we can talk to employees there. We look at surveillance cameras. That will probably generate some leads. We know that the components all came from someplace. If we're lucky, we'll have a hardware store, perhaps, that could tell us that somebody on a certain date bought components that we find in those pipe bombs. And then we have lab analysis of the packages themselves. We have a very robust laboratory in Quantico, Virginia. And if we're good and hopefully lucky, we'll get some prints, some DNA, perhaps a hair, perhaps a fiber, and hopefully be able to match those to a suspect.
Of course, the FBI leading this investigation, you talked a little bit about the postal inspectors, et cetera. Does local law enforcement get involved as well? Because I want to talk to you about the overall cooperative nature of law enforcement from the federal down to the local level.
Sure, they will. In fact, New York City Police will be instrumental in this particular case. Almost every case we work, from a federal angle will have some type of local law enforcement or other federal or state partnership in it.
Okay. So depending on, I guess, who spots it, if a citizen spots it and they just say, I'm just going to call my local police, it can work its way up the chain, you know, or what?
Sure, certainly. That's a very common thing. A local police department starts to work a case, then they notice that it has a wider network of perhaps criminals or potential crimes that are being conducted all at the same time, and they would perhaps notify the state police, who may turn around and talk to us, or they may come to us directly.
Mm-hmm. So these have happened in multiple locations, cities, states, et cetera. How do the FBI offices coordinate? And you said nothing here so far, but is your office called in? You know, is it sort of an all hands on deck in this?
It is. We have five operational divisions back at FBI headquarters. That division will sort of run the case. So this case is probably being run out of the counterterrorism division. They will coordinate all the different field offices for work that needs done on this particular case, even though it's being sort of led by one particular division. So if they find an address that might need chased down in Pittsburgh, counterterrorism will cut a lead to Pittsburgh and my agents will cover it.
At this point, is your office involved?
We haven't seen nothing substantial in Pittsburgh. Nothing for us to do on this particular case here.
Okay. Is this the kind of thing that you're confident in bringing to, I know this is speculation, bringing to a successful conclusion? What is it you need? Or do you think you're getting enough evidence to track down that individual or individuals?
Sure. Again, our lab analysis will probably give us some good leads. I think right now, today, I saw an open source that we're looking at a postal facility in Florida. Will probably generate leads. I think it will probably only be a matter of time until we catch the person responsible.
We mentioned at the top how many, per official FBI Twitter just now, an 11th package has been recovered in Florida, similar in appearance to the others addressed to Senator Cory Booker. New York Times is reporting this morning a 12th explosive device was delivered to CNN. So, the person or persons have not been dissuaded, I guess?
Apparently not so. Bombers will tend to continue to do this until they're caught. I think it's just a matter of time until we can put the pieces together, hopefully fast enough before one of these detonates and hurts somebody.
And have we been fortunate? Do we know enough yet whether they could actually detonate? When we're calling them pipe bombs, we're calling them explosive devices, but do we know if they were actually capable of detonating?
We don't. They're at the lab now, and they will determine whether or not that would have been possible.
All right. I'm going to move on to some other things. So many things to talk to you about. Earlier this month, you and U.S. Attorney Scott Brady announced that an investigation that you two had led resulted in the indictment of Russian military intelligence officers in hacking and disinformation campaigns. Who was targeted? How much harm was done?
Sure. That particular indictment in October, the targets of that Russian military activity was the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in Colorado, the World Anti-Doping Agency in Montreal, the Canadian Center for Ethics in Sports in Ottawa, the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons there in the Netherlands, and then Westinghouse. It was a series of targets being looked at by those particular GRU military officers.
So they're indicted, but these military intelligence officers are still in Russia. So what good does the indictment do?
That's a great question as well. We are very happy that we were able to identify Russian military intelligence officers as the ones behind that attack. That's pretty rare. Only a few field offices have actually identified military officers from adversarial countries. Pittsburgh's done two. We indicted five Chinese officers in 2014. So even though we probably won't arrest them anytime soon, we're 95% there when it comes to what we wanted to get done with this particular case.
If they travel to a country that the U.S. has an extradition treaty with?
Yes.
So what do you have people on alert looking for?
We will file red notice with Interpol, and any Interpol-related country, and I believe there's over 200, should notify us if somebody crosses into their country with identifiers matching those subjects in that case.
You've done all this work, all this intelligence gathering, to indict You have a case. Do you get frustrated that you don't have your hands on them?
A little bit. But again, I'm very, very happy that we were able to actually get them indicted and get these red notices out. That's 95% of the battle force.
Can you get ahead of these hackers before any damage is done rather than identifying the criminals afterwards?
We can. We do that by our outreach with our private partners, Fortune 500 companies. We tell them what the adversary may be looking for and hope that they can identify something before it happens and let us know that perhaps attempts are taking place at their facilities.
We have just a minute left, too many questions, so I want to ask you, what is your greatest fear? Is it a terrorist act?
We dedicate significant resources to preventing terrorism. We have, again, significant outreach, great law enforcement cooperation when it comes to terrorism. We would hope that somebody would be able to spot something before it happened for us and let us know. I think my greatest fear is our opioid crisis right now. In Western PA and West Virginia, we've got a problem. 737 deaths in 2017. It's third in the country behind only New York and Chicago. I think that's something we need to dedicate significant resources to.
In our last few seconds, literally, what do you think is the number one thing to do about that?
Everything. I can't arrest my way out of this. I need participation from all segments of society to attack this problem.
Robert Jones is the special agent in charge of the FBI's Pittsburgh office that goes throughout western Pennsylvania into West Virginia. Robert Jones, thanks so much for joining us on The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Today on the program, 90.5 WESA concludes its 8-part series on the disparities and systemic problems plaguing Pittsburgh public schools. What did we learn? How did the data inform the reporting? And what solutions are already in the works? The reporting team joins us just ahead. And the University of Pittsburgh's women's volleyball team is on a hot streak with 22 straight wins. WESA's Maria Scapoletto went to a recent match to see how the number 5 team in the nation is dominating the court. Find these and other stories on air and online at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Larkin Page Jacobs. The Pittsburgh Public Schools Board has rejected a measure that would have allowed school police to carry guns. The head of Aqua America, which has bid to buy People's Gas, says he's interested in working with the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority to provide water to residents. And while climate change threatens the world, it's not getting much attention in the Pennsylvania governor's race, despite the state's reputation as an energy hub. Get more top news by signing up for our newsletter at wesa.fm/inbox edition.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Politics can be a full contact sport, especially in an election year like this one. 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter reports that a bare-knuckle fight is playing out just north of Pittsburgh in the 16th Congressional District.
It's a Sunday afternoon, and Ron DiNicola is punching a heavy bag at a gym just uphill from a factory in Farrell, Pennsylvania. It's a perfect campaign stop for the former Marine and boxer to deliver his message.
Washington's broken. Send in the Marines. Let's fix the problem.
DiNicola is a lawyer who's represented Muhammad Ali and practiced criminal law in California. He's also been active in his hometown of Erie. He touts his community work there, which includes securing federal aid for workers who lost their jobs to foreign competition. He's run for Congress twice and came within 1% of winning in 1996. This year, he's facing not just Republican rival Mike Kelly, but another political heavyweight.
Mike is strong on crime, tough as hell on borders, powerful on trade, and he is really great on jobs. You see what he's doing.
President Donald Trump came to Erie for an October rally to support Kelly and other Republicans. Kelly of Butler is a car dealer. He was first elected in 2010 and was one of Trump's earliest supporters. Ask him if his race is a referendum on Trump, and he is happy to answer.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yes, of course.
In 21 months, he has changed the entire trajectory of our economy.
The 16th District stretches from Erie County down to Butler, and it joins industrial small towns and rural areas with the city of Erie. Trump won here easily in 2016. The district became more Democratic-friendly after the state Supreme Court redrew it this year. Still, DiNicola plays down questions about Trump, even as he blasts Kelly for backing the president's 2017 tax cuts.
He voted for a tax bill that benefits primarily the wealthy and doesn't do enough for middle-class and working-class voters of western Pennsylvania. So he's got his own accounting to do.
Andrew Blosier is a professor of political science at Allegheny College in Meadville. The day after Trump's rally, he said the visit reflected Republican concerns about Kelly.
It's a sign of how competitive this race is, that of all the places that Donald Trump could have been last night, he came to Pennsylvania's 16th district to support Mike Kelly.
Northwest Pennsylvania has seen economic gains in recent years, but some Trump policies are having mixed results. One area manufacturer, NLMK, warns that Trump's tariffs on steel imports may force it to cut over 700 jobs. Kelly says he's seeking a waiver on tariffs for NLMK, but he also tells the story of a Newcastle manufacturer who said the tariffs on his own business were a necessary short-term pain.
He looked me in the eye, he says, President Trump wasn't here 39 years ago. He is trying to do overnight what prior politicians have allowed to take place in the last 40-some years. And I said, you know what? That just makes sense.
As for DiNicola,
he's kind of got that Rodney King thing. Listen, can't we all just get along and I can work with President Trump? My gosh, you already got somebody who's working with President Trump. You don't need to worry about that, my friend.
The race has been bitter, especially at a bruising October 8th debate. Here's DiNicola on Kelly's votes to rescind the Affordable Care Act, popularly referred to as Obamacare.
We need to bring down the profiteering of the insurance companies, but you're not going to see this out of that Congress. They're voting to marginalize and eliminate coverage for pre-existing conditions.
And here's part of Kelly's response.
We have always kept pre-existing conditions in there. Now, Ron, I'm going to watch your nose. If you keep talking this way, that nose is going to go the whole way out the back of this. If you could just stick to the truth, it'll make a big difference.
Independent experts warned that Republican efforts to repeal Obamacare would have weakened rules that protect people with pre-existing conditions from being charged higher premiums. Kelly leads in polls, although Blosier, the political science professor, says DiNicola can still win.
Mike Kelly has some advantages that come with being an incumbent in a district that tends to lean Republican. It's his race to lose right now, but by a very slight margin.
Voters will be the ringside judges on Election Day. Chris Potter, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh Public Schools faces challenges. One, academic achievement. White students consistently faring better than black students. Two, enrollment. Less than half of parents choose their neighborhood school. Today, we conclude our series, Dividing Lines. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider reports district leaders are trying to figure out how to meet those challenges.
School board member Salah Uddin stood in front of a crowded room of concerned parents and community members this week and promised change. The high school in his district, University Prep 6 through 12, performs poorly in state standardized tests. 90% of students are black, and most are scoring at the basic level. Uddin says turning around the school begins with a conversation.
You start by admitting that we are failing, and you start pulling all hands on deck, bringing everybody to the table, coming up with ideas.
The problems at that school are reflected more broadly at the district level. Today, white students make up a third of the district's enrollment, and African Americans about half. But white children are far more likely to be enrolled in at least one advanced placement course, and students of color are far more likely to be suspended out of school. A district-wide effort to bring everyone to the table is just beginning. At this year's State of the District address, Superintendent Anthony Hamlet stressed that transformational change is slow, difficult work. As the theme song from the movie Chariots of Fire played in the background, Hamlet accepted a gold baton from the Brashear High School senior who introduced him. He paced the stage while video of the Pittsburgh Marathon played behind him. It's a metaphor he has embraced while talking about how to improve the district.
It's not a sprint, it's a marathon. We are committed to completing each leg of the race to reach our desired long-term outcomes for our students.
In order to finish the race, Hamlet says the district needs a better lay of the land. He's awaiting the results of a demographic study the district commissioned this time last year. The study will look at where students live and where they are attending school, both public and private. It will also capture data on race and socioeconomic status. For decades, leaders in Hamlet's position focused on racial balance in schools as the key to addressing achievement disparities, because historically, white schools have received more resources than black schools. But the district has pivoted. Hamlet says further integrating schools isn't his primary goal. His goal is to make sure all schools are good schools. And that starts with believing all students, black or white, rich or poor, can achieve.
And that's the difference maker to me. If we have high expectations for all students and meet them where they are and lift them up, then we'll see equity begin to manifest itself in a more robust way in our schools right now.
But exactly how that manifests in schools remains to be seen. Hamlet says everything is on the table. Opening schools, closing schools, changing feeder pattern lines, or throwing the whole map out the window and letting parents choose which school to send their kids to. Erica Fairby-Jones is Hamlet's chief of staff, and she says any change has to have buy-in from the community.
We want to talk to people about this. We don't want to do anything that is haphazard, ill-informed, and does not have a ton of engagement around it.
But community meetings, drafting plans, going back to the community and board, not to mention actually executing those plans, it all takes time. Board member Sala Udin says the system, including university prep, is failing black students now.
I wish more people were angry about it. I'm angry about it. It has to change, and it has to change quickly, not 75 or 100 years.
Parents are concerned. That's why most parents don't send their kids to neighborhood schools. University prep in the Hill draws kids from a wide swath of Pittsburgh neighborhoods, from downtown to North Oakland, up to Morningside. But only 18% of students assigned to attend the school actually go there. Some parents who spoke at the meeting about UPrep this week said they know that the choices they make affect other students, but they said they have to put their own children first. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
Where a child goes to school shapes their educational experience, and that in turn shapes their future. In 90.5 WESA's reporting series, Dividing Lines, The Shape of Education in Pittsburgh, a team of five reporters took a critical look at the map that assigns students to schools based on where they lived. I'm joined by three members from that team. Sarah Schneider is WESA's education reporter. Margaret J. Krause usually covers transportation and development. And Liz Reed is their editor, who shepherded the project through the summer. Welcome to you all.
Hello.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks.
Why this series? How did the topics come about? How do you feel they relate to each other?
Well, so we started looking at the map and we just started brainstorming, you know, story ideas based on what we saw. So we looked in the map, we had a lot of questions. Questions like, where did these islands come from? How did they even draw the borders? What are the criteria that they use? Questions like, well, why is the line here between, say, Alderdice and Westinghouse, which gives you two very different educational experiences? And when, you know, the map we have today, we know was put into effect in 2012. But to understand that map, we have to look at, okay, what came before? There was a bunch of school closures in 2006 and 2004. And then we start going back and we realize there was a desegregation plan. There was busing. And that made us realize we had to understand, why is Pittsburgh segregated in the first place?
How about you, Margaret?
This is, I think I don't know if you guys will agree with this, the overarching story of this series is that nothing happens by accident, but all of the things that we see around us as a result of discrete decisions made years ago, and they just pile up on top of one another. And for me, my story looked at why and how Pittsburgh came to be segregated. And it's the result of state, federal, and local policies over generations that resulted in a very segregated city.
So did the segregation just sort of bubble up, sort of rise in importance in influencing how the series came to be? Sarah?
Something I hear often from people who are very involved in this work is that the schools are very segregated because the city is very segregated. And it's something that a lot of people are aware of, but they just don't know what to do about that. We don't know if, is that the issue? Like, there's plenty of research to show that being in a diverse school benefits everyone involved in many, many ways. But that's not happening now. You know, kids are not in diverse schools if they go to their neighborhood school. So that was what we were interested into.
Thanks, Sarah. Margaret?
And it comes from the fact that Pittsburgh remains segregated, which is what busing tried to essentially solve for, was, well, people live in these different places in order to get everybody to a place where they are exposed to different kinds of people and different kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds, then we have to bus them. But I think, to Sarah's point, people are aware of segregation in Pittsburgh, but I think there's a sense that, oh, it happened by accident. This is just the result of individual decisions piling up, when in fact it stems directly from federal policies that promoted segregation where there hadn't previously been segregation. So, for instance, when the federal government decided to build public housing, which was for middle-class families because of the housing squeeze after the Great Depression, those new buildings were segregated. When the war, when the United States finally got into the war, they built defense housing. That was segregated. When home ownership was subsidized by the federal government in the post-war period, it was much harder for an African-American family to get an insured mortgage. And in fact, suburbs, when they were built, many of them had this caveat that the federal government would not insure mortgages unless there was a covenant that said these homes could not be resold to black families. And all of that has repercussions because what we're seeing is wealth disparity, not income disparity. And wealth disparity covers generations.
Margaret, why didn't the desegregation efforts in all, in Pittsburgh public schools and in other urban school districts throughout the nation, why didn't that solve it, especially if this feeder pattern came years and years after those desegregation efforts?
Liz has spent the last 6 months diving deeply into desegregation efforts and their efficacy or lack thereof. So I'm going to kick to Liz.
So the reason why busing didn't work in Pittsburgh, and I think it's something people have come to realize today, you can't solve educational disparities by just moving some kids out of their neighborhood into a different school. And most of the time, these are black kids, a select group of black kids being sent to a different school. That doesn't fix segregation, because segregation isn't something that just exists in schools. Segregation is much bigger. You know, it's existed in this country for centuries, and you can't just send a few kids on a school bus to fix a problem that big. So the point is, today, a lot of people don't see the value in desegregation for desegregation's sake. They make the argument that you can provide black students great educations in their black neighborhoods, in their black schools. There's nothing that precludes someone from getting a great education just because their school is mostly black.
Okay. So, Margaret, one of the pieces that you did for this series talked about long commutes of the students. Why do some parents think that the long hours on those buses are worth it? What did you find?
Sure. So at first, the data was roughly 800 pages from the district, and it was mostly elementary school students, some middle school. And at cursory glance, we thought, okay, let's just look for the long commutes and see who those kids are. It turns out to be far more confusing than that. Magnet students, so these schools that Sarah talked about where parents have to apply and children have to achieve a spot with various weights, it's a lottery, those students do tend to have longer commutes than most children in Pittsburgh public. And the parents say it's worth it because some seek a more alternative education like Montessori, or they want their kids to experience a specialized track such as STEM or STEAM or an arts track. But we also found that children attending neighborhood schools can have very long commutes. There's sort of two main groups, one where there's lots of kids on a bus, the route is relatively short, or fewer children on a bus and their route is relatively long. And that's for a lot of reasons. One is that kid commutes are affected by the same factors as adult commutes, so terrible traffic, accidents, detours, rivers, hills, tight corners, and also because of the choices or needs of individual families affecting the district transportation decisions.
All right, Margaret. Sarah, as WESA's education reporter, you were pretty familiar with a lot of these parental concerns and issues. Margaret, you've covered your fair share of bad housing policy. What would you say that each of you have learned, and what are you going to take away from the project? Sarah, we'll start with you.
I would say, you know, the district acknowledges that where you live impacts where you go to school, but the district also says that that shouldn't impact the quality of your education. And, you know, I would say that this district is pretty on fire. They have a plan, and they say that they're going to make changes, but it's going to take a long time. And that doesn't sit well with a lot of parents because, you know, they're sending their kids to school right now. And I went to a community meeting this week where a lot of parents who send their kids to UPREP, which is a school in a high school in the Hill District, were saying, you know, I want to send my kid to a neighborhood school. I believe in public schools, but I'm not going to do it right now because UPREP is not achieving. Their standardized test scores are pretty low, and I'm not going to risk my child's 4 years of education. And so, you know, I hear where the district's coming from. They feel very positive and motivated to do this work, but it's going to take a long time, and that's hard to sit with.
Margaret.
What's interesting about federal policy and the legacy of state and local policy around segregation, around housing, around these issues of education, these decisions were made 80 years ago, and we're still living with a legacy, which is both sad, but in some ways hopeful, in that if there was a concerted effort to make marked change now, we could see a more positive legacy of decisions being made today.
Liz, as editor of the series, what did you learn?
Well, I learned a ton, but I think the biggest takeaway for me is, you know, Sarah, Margaret, and I are all in our late 20s to mid 30s. We grew up in an era, we had a picture of Ruby Bridges in our textbooks. That's how we learned about school integration. And what we learned, it was pretty simplistic. It was that segregation is bad, integration is good. We didn't learn a lot of nuance of why. And if you go back to Brown v. Board, Thurgood Marshall argued that desegregation was a means to an end, to give every kid a good education, black kids and white kids. And because white kids were getting more resources in their schools, you had to have black kids and white kids in the same schools in order for them to get equal resources, equal education. Separate but equal did not work. That's what the Supreme Court decided. In Pittsburgh, when there was a mandate from the state, and this is jives with what we learned as kids, segregation was no longer a means to an end. Desegregation became an end unto itself. And as some people have told me, it's not valuable. What is valuable is providing good education to all children. So today, that's what the focus is for the school district. That's what they say they're going to do. As Sarah mentioned, it's a very difficult task. And it occurred to me in some of the conversations I was happening that if every school was a great school, maybe desegregation, maybe further integration of our neighborhoods would be a byproduct of providing great education for every child, black or white.
Liz Reed's an editor at WESA. Margaret J. Krause and Sarah Schneider are reporters at WESA. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WESA reporter Sarah Bowden and intern Zach Goldstein also contributed to the Dividing Lines series. You can find their collected works at wesa.fm/dividinglines. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
The hunt is on for whoever sent pipe bombs to some of the president's critics. CNN wrestles with reporting the news and being one of the bombers' targets. Also, the midterm campaigns hit the home stretch, the Red Sox round the bases, and Sandra Day O'Connor steps away from public life. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
This morning at 10 on 90.5 WESA.
WESA is supported by Duquesne University, offering 80 undergraduate majors in fields like education, healthcare, business, music, liberal arts, and more. Faculty mentors and internship opportunities are designed to prepare students for success in the workplace. More information is available online at duq.edu.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Something extraordinary has been happening in athletics at the University of Pittsburgh. And it has nothing to do with the football team or the upcoming basketball season. The undefeated women's volleyball team is generating a lot of excitement on campus with a record of 22-0. It's the best start to the season in the history of the program at Pitt. WESA's Maria Scapoletto wanted to find out more about these athletes who are serving up victory after victory for the university.
The weather was gray and dreary when I trudged up the hill to the Fitzgerald Fieldhouse on the University of Pittsburgh campus on a recent Sunday afternoon, but the mood brightened considerably as soon as I got inside. It's the sound of victory again, the volleyball team winning yet another match, their 22nd in a row to be exact. On this particular day, they beat a tough opponent in Louisville. The record standing room only crowd of more than 2,100 fans was exuberant. Among them, alum Neil Guberman.
Pitt, you know, it doesn't take much to make us happy, and this is way over the top.
And what exactly does he like best about this group of athletes?
Teamwork, heart, poise, dedication, and a smile on their face.
Division I volleyball may be tough, but so are these players, says Pitt Athletic Director Heather Like. She says what they've achieved thus far has been amazing.
They believe in each other. They work hard. I mean, they are the prototypical perfect student athletes in every sense of the word.
And Like says that will serve them well heading into the home stretch.
It's just starting. So, you know, we got a lot of road yet to go and finish the ACC season, and then obviously, hopefully, have great expectations in the NCAA tournament.
Dana Van Buskirk says these young women have what it takes to get there. She should know. Her daughter, Lane Van Buskirk, a junior middle on this talented team, is number 7.
They love the pressure. They have a great coach, too, and they just love the pressure, and they just go one point at a time, and they just want to win. They want this bad, so they're going for it.
Player Stephanie Williams, an outside hitter, says the electricity and energy at home games really motivates them.
It's like surreal looking around and seeing everyone up in their seats, and especially I think it also plays an effect like on the other team as well. So the community sport is just awesome. We love it so much and feed off it.
Head coach Dan Fisher says his players also know each other really well, and that's helped them to excel. He says most of them have been playing together now for 2 years.
You know, we play well together. They're a really tight-knit group off the court. We've led the athletic department in GPA the last 2 years, so I feel really good about the way this team represents Pitt.
For 90.5 WESA News, I'm Maria Scapoletto.
And Maria joins me now in the studio to talk a little bit more about these young women who have been perfect on the court. Maria, we heard the athletic director talk about the road ahead. Just how tough is it?
Kevin, they have a handful of matches left in the regular season, which wraps up November 21st. After that, they're going to find out if they'll be chosen to be a host of the NCAA tournament. That would take place at the Peterson Event Center. You know, that's when the pressure really is going to kick in for them. I asked Coach Dan Fisher what he does to help them stay focused.
Whatever the rankings and whatever our record, it has never been the goal. The goal's been, you know, we've been for 2 years in a row. We've made the NCAA tournament and lost in the second round. So all season long, we've been talking about how can we make it past that second round. And first, you got to make the tournament. But hopefully, we're putting ourselves in a position to host the first and second round, which we think would give us a better chance. So, you know, we're going to keep working individually on getting better and with that goal in mind.
How has this had an effect on the greater community here at Pitt beyond volleyball and beyond even athletic?
I'm recognized more. The girls are recognized more around campus. You know, I've just gotten probably the coolest thing is how many people, alumni or boosters, or people have reached out and just really just been like, hey, coach, thank you so much for making us proud. And so that's a really great feeling.
And the crowds are swelling.
And the crowds, and it's, you know, it certainly doesn't hurt. And this is what we need to prepare us for the tournament where the crowds are going to be big.
But before the tournament, they still have to get through a handful of opponents, including a match tonight when they travel to North Carolina to take on Wake Forest.
So the Pitt women's volleyball team, they're ranked number 5 in the country. Who's ahead of them?
Pitt is right behind Penn State, believe it or not. Penn State has had a history of having a volleyball team that's just stellar. They've won many national championships.
They're ranked fourth. Third is Minnesota. Second, Stanford. And BYU is ranked number one. So they're right up there with the best of the best.
But can they climb any higher before the big tournament gets underway?
Well, Kevin, it's going to be difficult for them. Not impossible, because these other teams are so good, and Pitt doesn't have any ranked opponents left on their schedule. So the only way that could happen is if one of those top-ranked teams falters, and that's always possible.
Thanks so much, Maria.
You're welcome, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, development in the Pittsburgh region. Can it be equitable, sustainable, diverse, and healthy? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mix Dinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.